This is MSO, newsports.com. Joining us at this time is Rupika Rizam from Salem State University. And Rupika, I guess let's begin with the work. We'll have some visualizations up on the post here as well. But tell us about your digital work here that you've been working on here.
So the Torn Apart Separados project is a digital humanities project that is mapping and visualizing the locations of ICE detention centers across the United States, as well as the children's shelters that are housing juveniles who've been separated from their parents, and to demonstrate the vast reaches of ICE detention all throughout the landscape of the United States.
So that representation is the map of the United States, geographical map of the United States with the dots on it. And if someone were to look at that, what are they seeing with these dots?
So the large orange dots indicate ICE detention facilities that have been in use since 2014. The smaller orange dots are facilities that are contracted by the government for detention but that are not currently in use. And the lavender dots are the locations of shelters that are housing children who've been separated from their parents. And clicking on these dots gives you some information about the names of the facilities, as well as for the detention centers, their current populations.
Tell me about how you got interested and got involved with this kind of work.
So my research is in the area of digital humanities, which I first started engaging with when I was doing my master's degree in English at Georgetown University, and I worked for the Center for New Designs and Learning and Scholarship. And so we were thinking then about how to teach with technology. I then went on to do my PhD at Emory University, and while I was writing my dissertation and doing some research into the Black Panther Party, I came across the roles of subscribers for the Black Panther newspaper, and it really demonstrated this kind of vast geographical reach of Black Panther ideology. And so I started to think about, were there ways to visualize that particular data? And that's how I ended up starting to do my work in digital humanities.
Which I want to follow up on that in a moment, but as far as digital humanities within the classroom, say, here at Salem State, what does that look like too?
So it depends on the course. Sometimes it's as minimal as in my African American literature course, where I ask students to use digital tools for textual analysis and to compare the output of a website that can tell them about word counts and word collocations and trends in vocabulary in a piece of writing to their own close reading that they do just by reading alone. In a class that's specifically on digital humanities or on digital studies, I've done everything from engaging students in mapping to think about how they could map literature to using network analysis to look at the relationships between characters within a literary text to interpreting social media as well to understand trends in contemporary culture.
The group that you've been working with in regards to the topics that we're discussing here, with the mapping and so on, with the Columbia University people and the University of Houston, tell me how you got involved with that group, and tell us more about their work and the work that you were all doing.
So the Group for Experimental Methods at Columbia University was founded about 5 years ago by several friends of mine, Alex Hill, Manan Ahmed, and Dennis Tenen. And they do a lot of really interesting work thinking about how we can use digital humanities to intervene in social justice issues. And so, you know, we've been friends for a while, and when the news first came out in early June about children that had supposedly been lost by the U.S. government, Alex Hill and I started doing research into what was going on because people were saying these were children who had been disappeared by the government after being taken from their families. And through our research, we actually learned a lot about how the government handles unaccompanied minors who arrive at the border and all the different kind of levels of custody of those children, and realized at that moment that actually those children were unaccompanied minors. They had not been taken from their parents. They had simply arrived without parents or without family members. And so also a number of those children were allegedly lost because they weren't responding to phone calls and weren't showing up to court dates. But that some of the reasons for that was that they were released to the custody of undocumented family members who didn't feel safe to come to court. Because they were fearing deportation. So at that moment, we decided there was absolutely nothing to do with our digital humanities skills other than tell people what we found and share our research with people. And we actually figured all that out a few days ahead of the social media cycle on this issue. Fast forward about 2 weeks, and we started to see the news reports coming out about families being separated, photos of children, and then stories of the mother who had her infant taken away from her while she was breastfeeding. And so again, we started revisiting this question of whether there was something to do. And so Alex Hill had put out a tweet asking if anybody had any data related to Customs and Border Patrol. And so I sort of jumped in and I said, actually, we have some of that from the research we were doing several weeks ago. And so really quickly, kind of in a matter of an hour, a group kind of coalesced with some of the people from Columbia, some colleagues we know from the University of Houston, and two from other institutions. And then we all started working together. We parked 3 days to find the data, and we weren't sure what we were going to do with it. We came across the data, a data set that had been FOIA'd already from the Center for Immigration Justice, and they had all these detention centers, and they had the number of juvenile facilities, but they didn't have any of the names. They were all redacted. So then my particular contribution to this project was actually specifically going and manually finding all of those shelters.
The other graphic that you have is the border crossing. So I want you to kind of explain that and what that one illustrates. If folks take a look at that one, if they're listening and looking at the website as well, the border cross. Describe that one to us, and what does that tell you?
So all along the Mexico-United States border are a number of points of entry where people can enter the United States, and this is where asylum seekers should be able to go to seek asylum. And they're indicated on the south edge of the orange overlay on the visualization by semicircles. Those semicircles are the points of entry. What's happening at the moment is that asylum seekers are not being welcomed in through the ports of entry. They're being denied the opportunity to seek asylum. And because they're fleeing really desperate circumstances like poverty and violence, they're highly motivated to be able to seek asylum. And since they can't come in through the ports of entry, they're crossing the borders in the spaces between the ports of entry, which are indicated by straight lines. And when they cross over the straight lines and not the semicircle indentations, that's when they're actually committing a crime. So it shows this kind of strange tension between these places where it's acceptable to cross the border and to seek asylum, but where they're being denied the ability to do that, and then these spaces where they can cross, but then they're likely to get caught by Border Patrol, and then suddenly they are criminalized for their desire to seek asylum.
When you do this kind of work, you're looking to make a difference, make an impact. So what does this show you as far as being able to make a difference or make an impact?
So for almost all of us on the project are immigrants ourselves, and particularly since 9/11, we've been very aware of the infrastructure around immigration. I mean, it used to be INS, and then it became separated into several offices, including ICE. And, you know, particularly in moments like when we cross borders, when I come back to Logan Airport from traveling abroad, I'm conscious of the fact that I am an immigrant. I'm conscious of the fact that even though I'm a naturalized citizen, that as a woman of color, you know, there's this sort of sense of, you know, whether or not I have the right to belong in the United States. And every single one of us who worked on this project was a person of color, and most of us immigrants. And so, you know, we've always been conscious that immigrant detention is out there, that immigration enforcement is out there, and that, you know, for someone like me, I came to the U.S. as a child and grew up here, and I was able to get citizenship because my parents were able to get citizenship, and so I was able to get naturalized because of them. But that's just an accident of my birth. I did nothing to so-called deserve the right to be in the United States. And my parents came out of choice. They didn't come out of fleeing danger. And so for me, there's this strange cognitive dissonance of having been given the right to live and to work in the United States, despite having really no need for it. And I could have been fine in England. And also having, and without doing anything, right? And then these people who are coming and who are so desperate are being told, no, you're not allowed in. And so that particular sentiment really motivated my involvement with the project. And what we were hoping to show is that other people need to be aware also of how deeply immigrant detention penetrates the entire landscape of the United States. It's not just at borders. It's not just at airports. It's in your own backyard.
I get, what would be the next phase of your work here and the group's work moving forward? Or sometimes you create a phase, you complete one phase, and you obviously see the next phase, but you don't see three more steps down the road right away. I would imagine that's how it can work. So what would be next and beyond that?
So our team, several members from the original team with several new people are currently working on a phase two. For now, we're envisioning this as the last phase because, as you can imagine, this is really intense work. We all have jobs that are not to do this. And so we have lives and families, and a lot of that is all falling by the wayside as we try to do this work under very quickly when it's rather labor intensive. Data visualization is very labor intensive. And so our current project is working on visualizing the money data. We were originally calling it Torn Apart, Follow the Money. Now it's just Torn Apart Volume 2. And so I found, I was able to scrape from the USAspending.gov database the contracts awarded by ICE to companies from 2013 to 2018. And so we are now developing a number of data visualizations to parse that data and represent it and show the financial side of this story. So we have some visualizations that are looking at increases in sizes of contracting awards made over time. We have some that are looking at connections between companies, very ordinary companies that we all patronize, like Amazon.com or AT&T, and the kinds of services that they're offering and the kinds of money they're making. And then we're also kind of looking at the financial cost of detention and deportation using that data.
And so this is all information that you can kind of pull off the internet, so to speak. And what is that? What else has that shown you at all with that kind of information?
So one thing that we noticed right away was the significant increase in spending in 2017. So 2013, 2014, 15, 16, it was steadily going up over the years, and then there was a boom in 2017, and then 2018 has even higher, a higher amount of awards that have been offered. It's interesting that the government differentiates between current total value of awards and potential total value of awards, so the amount that they've actually committed to pay versus the amount they potentially could pay. And when we look at the differential between 2018 in terms of how much money the government's already obligated on these contracts versus how much more, I mean, it's several billion more dollars that they are indicating they're willing to spend. They haven't committed to spending it yet. And that to me is a little bit haunting, much like those on the Clinks visualization, those detention centers that are unoccupied and just waiting to house detainees, right? They're just kind of ready and waiting, much like that. Those contracts are ready to be, have their options called for more money to be spent on this. That was sort of one of the immediate realizations. And then there are a lot of really fine details in the data around the kinds of services and products that are offered and why. So one of the dimensions we're looking at is, you know, what are the components that go into managing the operations of ICE, right? It's computers, it's subscriptions to The Economist, apparently. It's charter air service to deport people. It's socks for detainees. And so those details are really fine-grained in some of this data, and so we're trying to pull that out and to show people, think about this massive machine that surrounds this enterprise of enforcing immigration in the United States.
Well, it's big. It's big. There's no question about it. Hey, I want to ask you maybe one other question. Is the reaction that you're getting to this work from other, say, media outlets, if you will, nationally, internationally? Before we started this, you mentioned that you were on Korean radio. Was that right?
Yes.
So tell me about what they talked to you about on Korean radio. And how do you handle that, by the way? And then maybe a few other notes as well.
So it was an English language morning program in Korea, and they were really interested in having someone talk about the family separation immigration policy. And I'm not sure how they came across the project, but what happened when we were working on this project is that several of us were tweeting about what we were doing and what we were finding, and so we were contacted by a reporter from Wired. And so she did a story as we were working, a kind of behind-the-scenes story on how the project came together and how we were executing it. So that actually dropped the same day we launched the project. And so I think that Wired story got a lot of coverage. For the story. Funny enough, actually, the second major source of coverage for this was the Salem News story, which we didn't anticipate was going to be picked up by the AP Wire, and so it actually appeared on the websites of, you know, LA Times, Houston Chronicle, Chicago Tribune, Miami Herald. So the story got a lot of coverage.
And finally, MSO News Sports. It's taken a while, but here you are. So maybe Kim Burnett has a connection to Korea that we don't know about.
I don't think so.
Entirely possible.
Anything else you want to share with us about the whole, all of your work that you're doing here?
I would just also add that at Salem State, we actually now have a graduate certificate in digital studies that gives people the option to learn how to do work like Torn Apart Separados. So please get in touch with me, as I'm the coordinator of the program, if you're interested in learning more.
All right, we'll put some links up. Great talking with you, and thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Yep. That is Rubica Razam from Salem State University. I'm Bill Newell, and this is MSONewsSports.com.